You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Williams. I'm an attorney from Danville, Virginia, representing Ms. Ricketts on her appeal from the summary judgment granted against her in the case coming out of the Circuit Court of Danville, Virginia. And this is a case that we contend, when you look at it, goes beyond even the parties involved. And it's an important case because what it involves is how you interpret 34-4, our homestead deed here in Virginia. And just a real summary of the facts is basically Ms. Ricketts was involved in an automobile collision back on February 3rd, 2012.
Counsel, we're pretty familiar with the facts.
Let
me just tell you what bothers me about this.
Yes, sir.
I'm reading, her schedule, and I'm saying to myself, kind of get the feeling that she's trying to put down just enough information to make it over the legal goal line, but not enough to say, hey, I've potentially got a large personal injury case here. Either disabuse me of that or tell me that that's actually okay to do in bankruptcy practice or whatever, because it bothers me that I'm having to parse so carefully words where it would have been so easy to say personal injury case.
And Your Honor, I think if you look at the bankruptcy case cited in the brief, I believe by both sides, the Wilmot case, that was a concern raised by the bankruptcy court there, because what happened in the Wilmot case is that the actual health care providers were listed in the petition, and so they were being discharged in the bankruptcy, but the claim was not raised or was raised in our court. And so there, the Wilmot case said, well, we have concerns here. Of course, that was a bankruptcy issue in that particular case. But what they said there was prejudice being caused to the parties. There is prejudice actually being caused to the health care providers.
But that's not really the test. There was prejudice in that case. But the test is, did you identify the potential income stream or the potential asset carefully enough for someone to understand it?
And I agree, Your Honor. And the standard applied by the trial court, and what the trial court said, and that's the issue in its final order, said that used the test reasonable particularity under the circumstances then existing per claim. That's the standard that was used by the trial court.
Well, is line 18 in Schedule B a liquidated debt item or an unliquidated debt item?
It was not listed under Schedule B. It was listed only under Schedule C, and more importantly, it was listed under the homestead.
Is that not
a bankruptcy issue, as opposed to whether it was artfully enough stated in the homestead deed to claim the homestead exemption under 34-4? Because the bankruptcy petitions are subject to amendment, subject to change, but it was listed under Schedule C, and more importantly,
Ever listed under Schedule B?
It has not been, because it's not been gone back and amended at this point. And of course, in bankruptcy court, you can liberally amend, you can add creditors. Each of the creditors, and depending on what happens here, may have to be added to the bankruptcy. But it also could be listed under Schedule B.
So you're saying it was never listed under Schedule B?
It's not been listed. No one has gone back at this point, reopened the chapter.
I understand that, but you're saying originally it was not listed under Schedule B.
It was not listed.
Does she rely on potential funds due to debtor unknown at this time? Is that what she relies on?
That's right.
For Schedule B? That's Schedule C.
Under Schedule C.
Right.
And more importantly, it's listed, it's right in the homestead. And what the homestead deed says is, it specifically uses that language. She's exempting out insurance proceeds or proceeds related to claims or causes of action that may be asserted by the debtor. So she specifically put that as a contingent claim in her homestead, and that was exempted out without objection any concern by the Chapter 7 trustee.
Maybe it's because they didn't know what she was talking about.
Could be.
I mean, isn't that the whole problem? Is it so ambiguous that the trustee wouldn't know that you're talking about a personal injury claim? Because you're just talking about any claim that I might have anywhere.
Well, and I think it's interesting now, the trustees are in Western District are actually going back and asking at the 3-4-1 hearing now. They did not in the past say, listen, you have any pending, you know, possible personal injury claim or contingent claim out there. They were not even asking them up to that point. And of course, Mr. McClain, the Chapter 7 trustee here, said, I used due diligence to figure it out, but it was there. It may not have been as artfully as it could have been, but it was there. And what we have is we have a practice in bankruptcy court that has long been recognized that people claim nominal amounts just to cover things that are contingent and that can come up. And specifically, that's what's happened here. And so it was.
But if I were a bankruptcy trustee or I was advising one and I read insurance proceeds or proceeds .. that may be asserted, I would have no idea what that means. How much money are we talking about? What are the policy limits? Who's making the assertion? Has it already been made? Is it to be made in the future? Isn't that the kind of information you want the bankruptcy trustee to have to make a judgment as to whether or not to schedule a hearing with the bankruptcy judge?
And I'll answer your question in three ways. The answer is yes, you would want that. Two, the trustee has an obligation to go back and ask those questions. Just as the court may ask questions, the trustee, in doing the 341 investigation, has a duty to go back and ask. Three, this court has said these homestead deeds are to be liberally construed in favor of the debtor, not the other way around. Obviously, the best practice would be to have listed it and stated specifically what it is. I suspect the bankruptcy attorney in this particular case really put it in there because he or she had no idea what may have been there as far as what specifically was there. The trustee never asked about it.
You said that this claim wasn't listed under Schedule B, but it seems to be referenced in the assignment of error that it was. And look at the joint appendix on page 31.
Well,
the same language you mentioned.
I take it back. You're right.
Okay.
You're correct. Where my error was on that was I was talking about the creditors, and I apologize. The specifics of the claim. The general language, there was nothing that said on September 3rd I was involved in an automobile accident and I may have a contingent claim. Simply listed under B what was claimed, it was not under where it should have, would normally have been, it was under number 18 of the schedule. And it was just put in there in the general terms.
So let's pick that apart. You can't get an exemption under Schedule C of something that's not listed in Schedule B, correct?
Well, you can claim it.
How do you get an asset exempted from the bankruptcy court when you've not identified the asset?
You can do it just in general terms, especially in the contingent claims. You do not have,
So you can exempt something in Schedule C that you do not identify at all, ever, even generically, in Schedule B?
Well, what you do is you can put something in the homestead, and then you can come back and amend later and put specifically. But here what happened was it was never put in Schedule B specific. It was put in there just in the general terms of insurance proceeds and causes of action.
But isn't that your problem? Because in your homestead deed, you use exactly that same ambiguous language.
That's right.
Which means it was never put in the homestead deed either, right?
That language that you see in Schedule B was put in there. The specifics of the contingent claim have never been put in there saying we have a claim in such and such.
Counsel, you
yes, sir.
You were not the attorney that filed the Chapter 7.
No.
Okay. I got to tell you, I'm looking at this, and this looks like boilerplate to me. I don't have 100 other petitions that have been filed by the Schaefer Law Group, Cox Law Group.
Cox.
But when I see possible garnishment funds, insurance proceeds, proceeds related to claims or causes of action that may be asserted by the debtor, any claim for earned but unpaid wages and or inheritance, it looks rote. It looks like if they filed 100 of these or 1,000 of these, that language is in all 1,000 of them. And again, I want to go back to Justice Kelsey's question. How does this put the trustee on notice to even ask the questions? Well, what inheritance might you receive? what earned but unpaid wages might you receive? Do you have any garnishment funds coming forth? I mean, when the trustee is trying to run through, you know, Chapter 7 individual no asset cases, I'm guessing dozens a day.
I would agree.
How do they? What puts them on notice? Ah, I've got somebody here who was involved in an automobile collision and has $12,000 in medical bills. Therefore, there might be a substantial personal injury recovery.
Well, to start with the first part, well, I agree that this is something put in there to cover something that the attorney he or she may not be aware of. I do agree with that.
But it might not be the attorney's fault. It might be that Ms. Ricketts didn't let the attorney know. I don't know.
And, Your Honor, that's why the word, and this court has used the Homestead, described as a shield. And it's supposed to be liberally construed in favor of the debtor. We're not here to protect the trustee with this.
Well, it's one thing to liberally construe it to protect the debtor. It's another thing to say all you've got here is the same rote that would apply to, that would be put into every single case, and there's got to be at least something more than that.
And if that is in fact correct, then that's why this case is going to go beyond just the mere litigants, because that's something the bankruptcy court has done every day to protect the unknown contingent claims.
Well,
this wasn't unknown. That's the problem. I understand the unknown contingent claims. It appears that this was pretty well known.
Well, a good example is the tax refund. People may or may not know they're getting a tax refund.
You generally know if you've been injured by the negligence of someone else and $12,000 in medical bills resulted.
I agree that you or I may know, but a debtor may not know or may not appreciate it. And that's why, and I think that the evidence of that is shown by what was done. In the health care providers were ongoing at that point, apparently, and they're not even listed in the petition. I mean, if there was an idea from the debtor, okay, I'm going to try to act and hold back, the whole thing would have been put out there and there would have been prejudice caused. But there's not. But
this doesn't mean she loses her cause of action. It means the cause of action belongs to the estate and the trustee should have brought it. That's all. It's the statute of limitations mess up that caused the problem in this case, not the trustee's mess up.
Well, we attempted to substitute the trustee in, and that is included, and there's an issue whether the trustee could come in at this place.
Can I ask one last question?
Yes, sir.
In B, under 18 is liquidated debts. Pain and suffering, and a claim for pain and suffering, or a claim for future loss earning capacity, or a claim for future loss wages, is that a liquidated debt?
No, sir.
So when you get down to 21, paragraph 21, other contingent and unliquidated claims of every nature, the answer is none. So I don't mean it quite as harshly as I'm going to say it, but it's not so much as inspecific, it seems misleading, too.
Well, I do agree it proper would have been to place it there. It is in the schedules. It's not in the correct question. I agree with that. But once again, you go back and look at the healthcare providers are not listed. So, and the issue is, I contend whether or not it was artfully done to preserve it, not necessarily whether it was an intent to deceive.
I'm not suggesting it's an intent to deceive, but it is facially misleading. If you put that on my desk and I'm the lawyer, I'm going to say there are no unliquidated claims of any nature. There's an affirmative statement, no. The box no is checked. So the representation to the trustee is, all right, I've got 30 of these on my desk. What should I do with this one? Well, there's nothing unliquidated. Move on. There's not enough time to worry about that. And what is this liquidated debt? Well, whatever it is, it's not much. Let's just let that go. And then we find out years later, no, there's a $400 or whatever $1,000 claim for pain and suffering.
But that can happen with a liquidated animal. You put it down and you guess at what it is at that time, and it can be a lot more. For example, inheritance or something like that happens all the time. And so therefore, you know, if we look at what the trustee should have done, the trustee should have asked. And it just never was asked at that point.
Why are you going to put the burden on the trustee when there's affirmative misleading by the debtor?
Well,
I mean, the case law in the bankruptcy court, well into the federal circuits, makes it absolutely clear that the burden is on the debtor to have a sufficient recitation of assets and claims for exemptions. Why do you? I mean, where do you get the authority to shift that burden to the trustee?
Well, but is that not a bankruptcy issue? If in fact the bankruptcy court was concerned about the asset, it would go back to the bankruptcy court. It would not be for the state court to decide. Here, the decision is, because it's a Virginia law, whether or not under 34.4 she properly preserved the contingent cause of action. You know, the bankruptcy law is the bankruptcy law. It's not for us here in the state court to decide whether or not it was done properly or not. That's the duty of the trustee. The trustee can always come back now, as we speak today, and we could attempt to try to come back and do that.
At this moment, it's valueless. Well, the trustee's not going to unless we reverse and send it back.
The trustee's expressed an interest in coming back, yes. That's why Mr. McClain tried to come into the case. But at this point, is that not a bankruptcy issue, though?
I think it's our issue first.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jason Moyers with Franklin Miller and Webb and Rowan, and I am here today on behalf of the appellee, Charlie Edward Strange. And Mr. Strange asks this court to please affirm the judgment of the circuit court for the city of Danville that found in favor of Mr. Strange on the following grounds. Number one, the appellant, Ms. Ricketts, failed to schedule in Schedule B of her Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition her personal injury claim against Mr. Strange arising out of the motor vehicle collision in which the two of them were involved mere months prior to the filing of her petition. Number two,
Does the record reflect whether Ms. Ricketts knew that Mr. Strange was the potential liable party or not?
It does, Your Honor. As the documentation that was submitted by agreement and without objection to the court below for consideration in ruling on our motion, the very day of the accident, Ms. Ricketts, had gone to her treating physician and said, a guy ran a red light this morning and hit me and was claiming injury from it. And she repeated that to her doctors. And then when she went to see her chiropractor, she said in an intake questionnaire, a guy ran a red light and struck me. Also, by the time she had filed for bankruptcy, she had submitted a claim for personal injury and property damage to Mr. Strange's insurer. And there was, without objection, documentation submitted to the court below for consideration that showed repair estimates that were generated by the insurer, correspondence from the insurer to Ms. Ricketts saying, we're considering your claim, we'll keep you posted on the progress of that and so forth. And so she obviously knew Mr. Strange because she knew which insurance company to submit her claim to, and all the correspondence that was returned back to her by the insurance company referenced Charlie Strange as the insurer.
So had she made a demand for settlement? Does the record reflect whether she had made a demand for settlement or had suggested that a settlement was possible?
I don't believe she had, Your Honor. By the date of her filing of her petition, she had incurred about $12,000 in change in medical specials, and she was continuing to treat. Based on the documentation that was submitted by Ms. Ricketts with her written discovery responses in the underlying personal injury action that brought us here today, she identified, by looking at the dates of treatment, she had about $12,000 or so in medical expenses by the time she filed for bankruptcy, and by the time she got her discharge about 4 months later, she had incurred another $3,000 or $4,000, so she was continuing to treat. So it would appear that she was not in a position at that time to settle. I do not have any record of her having tendered a demand or any offers or demands being exchanged.
Does the record reflect whether or not she had an attorney at that time?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I did not. In the documentation that we were provided by Mr. Strange's insurance company, there was no letter of representation in there from any attorney. It appears to have been correspondence back and forth and communication between Ms. Ricketts and the insurance company. But at bottom, Ms. Ricketts clearly knew she had been involved in an accident on February the 3rd, 2012. She knew who Charlie Strange was, at least by the time she submitted a claim to his insurance company. She knew that, as far as she was concerned, Mr. Strange was the at-fault party. She said as much to her doctor the very afternoon of the collision. Yet when she files her Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition, nowhere in the schedules, B, C, or otherwise, is there any mention of February 3rd, 2012. Nowhere is there any mention of the fact she was in an accident. Nowhere is there any mention of Charlie Strange. Nowhere is there any mention of the fact that she considers him to be liable or that she had a pending claim at that time for both property damage.
Can you help me understand this? And this may be neither here nor there, but in what way was there any harm to the creditors? Let's assume you're right, that she should have done this, she didn't. What could they have recovered out of this?
Well, as the courts have made clear, a bankruptcy does confer, in the end, a sizable benefit or reward to the honest debtor. And in exchange for that, the debtor is obligated to submit a full, complete listing of his...
Because my understanding is, and I understand that there's this process, you have to follow it, but my understanding is the entirety of the personal injury recovery would have been exempted from the creditors to satisfy any of her debts. Is that right or is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, here the trustee and the bankruptcy court and the creditors were never given an opportunity to make that determination. And in this court's decision in Coker v.
But back to my question. Suppose she had done this. And so then the trust, in great detail, what portion of that would have gone to satisfy the creditors?
I don't know, Your Honor. That's an excellent question. It would have been up to the trustee and the bankruptcy court to determine. But as this court...
Because my understanding is under the homestead exemption, it would have been out.
Well, the homestead exemption, of course, has a maximum of $5,000, whereas the personal injury exemption in the Virginia Code, by my reading, is unlimited. But, of course, as this court recognizes...
And so it's because she parked it under homestead, it wouldn't have fallen under the personal injury.
Well, no, we submit, Your Honor, that in order to claim any exemption whatsoever, it has to be listed appropriately in the schedules. And as this court, in the Cobra case, this court considered whether the debtor plaintiff there had fulfilled his obligations to schedule his claim in his bankruptcy schedules, even though it was a personal injury claim like Ms. Ricketts' claim here, and even though, well, one would suspect that perhaps had it been scheduled that the bankruptcy trustee and the court ultimately may have allowed it to be fully exempt, but that did not factor into the end result that the debtor did not honor his obligations in that case to list the claim in his schedules so that the bankruptcy court, the trustee, and the creditors would be on notice of its existence and could consider it along with all the other...
I understand.
Assets.
So it's a formal process that you have to adhere to get the benefits. I understand that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me state it a little more harshly. It appears to me, nobody ever says this, but it appears to me this is in the nature of a penalty. You didn't do it right. You had the duty to be forthcoming. You weren't. You misled the bankruptcy court, and there's a price to be paid for that. Now, it's not my place to say that that's right or that's wrong, because I think the case law actually resolves it. But it's probably more in the nature of a penalty for not doing it properly.
Well, Your Honor, the courts do. In fact, the court in the Payne case from the Seventh Circuit did consider it to be harsh justice, or rough justice, that granted the debtors may lose the benefit of something that they otherwise might be entitled to, but to rule otherwise would be to basically encourage broad general categories of assets and so forth being in the petition that really don't tell anybody anything. And then if you're later discovered to have omitted something that may have some value to the bankruptcy estate, you can say, oh, it was in that general category that I included in my petition.
And place that in the larger context, which is the law is giving you a fresh start. You're getting something you had no natural law right to. You had no expectation to. The law is going to allow you to cut off a lot of debt that you owe to other people who are going to feel like they've been treated harshly because they didn't get their debts paid. And the collateral response should be, yeah, and I'll be straight up with you. Can I change your attention, though, to Schedule C? Schedule C is the exemption schedule.
Yeah.
B is the asset schedule. You don't get an exemption under C unless you identify it in B, right, so far? And you only get the exemption in C, as I read the cases, for what you claim your exemption is. You can't just say exemption. You got to name the exemption, and the exemption doesn't include anything other than what you've named. So far, so good? All right, so
that was my understanding, Your Honor.
Under Schedule C, in this case, what was the exemption claimed?
It was the very same, we would submit, and as the court recognized, we believe also the boilerplate language from Schedule B, which is pretty much cut and pasted into Schedule C.
Would it be categorized as limited to the homestead exemption?
Well, Your Honor, what was claimed in the exemption in Schedule C was the very same language from line item 18 in Schedule B, which, as Your Honor pointed out, deals with liquidated claims. And also, what's in line item 8, what was put by Ms. Ricketts in response, number one, was in the wrong place in the petition. Number two, it was too ambiguous in general to really tell anybody anything about
it. I guess what I'm getting at is, even if he were to win the case, would he be limited to the $5,000 cap of the homestead exemption? Because that's the exemption claimed. Suppose, theoretically, the court were to say, look, we'll just let you say whatever you want to in Schedule B, because we don't like harsh results. Would that nonetheless mean you only get an exemption under C for what you claimed, and would that limit him to the homestead $5,000 cap?
If this court were to conclude that Ms. Ricketts did say enough in her Schedule B, which of course we say she did not, and the fact that she claimed it under her homestead exemption, we would believe would in fact limit her to what the law.
Well, why isn't that the obvious prejudice? If that's the law, if that's the way bankruptcy law works, and I'm a trustee and I've got a lot of things to worry about, and you're telling me I need to go schedule a hearing to see if this $5,000 claim is legit, I'm going to say no, I don't have time to worry about it. But if you tell me there's a $500,000 claim, I might want to look into it.
Well, and that's where the burden on the debtor to be forthcoming in her schedules becomes all the more important. Had she put in her schedules auto accident claim, such and such a date, or even auto accident claim, as the case law who have considered what is reasonable particularity under the circumstances, what satisfies that burden, they have allowed where a debtor said just EEOC claims, that was enough. Slip and fall personal injury accident at work, that was enough. Claim for breach of contract, that was enough. But where they don't mention it, where they put it in some broad general category, and then only when it's discovered that the claim existed, then they come back and say, oh, no, it was in that safety net, if you will, that I put in my...
So in theory, even if there were an exemption that was applicable, that would return the asset, the chosen action, to the claimant, what was returned was $5,000 of whatever the claim is, unliquidated claim. Let's say it's $500,000. Is there something about my logic you question?
No, Your Honor, but the homestead deed in this particular case was not, she did not claim a full $5,000. She claimed, I think,
$4,376. $3,639.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so the only amount, if you will, that could conceivably from that total be attributable to a personal injury claim if one was determined to have been scheduled, was $1, because that is all, because in line item 18 on her Schedule B and Schedule C, that total that she assigned to that line item was the tax refund interest that she claimed to be entitled to, plus $1.
All right, so
and
then my point is
that $1 being the only value assigned.
Is my point better than I think it is, which is the exemption's $5,000 and you've maxed it out before we even talk about your personal injury claim?
Perhaps, Your Honor. But, of course, in order for Ms. Ricketts to even have standing to bring this lawsuit, she had to have scheduled it in her bankruptcy petition appropriately, which she did not do. And there was another case that was not in our brief, but we wanted to bring it to the court's attention. It was from the Oregon Appellate Court, BUCAK, B-U-C-A-K versus City of Portland, 96 Pacific 3rd, 362. And there was kind of a similar situation where the plaintiff debtor was in a motor vehicle collision. She later filed for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy action and then received her discharge. And in Schedule B, in Item 21, asking for unliquidated claims and contingent claims, she checked the box marked none, just as Ms. Ricketts did here. However, she did have a little bit more to go on. In her Schedule I, her statement of income, she listed that she had $800 a month in farmers insurance disability benefits. And in her statement of financial affairs, she said she had her automobile totaled in $2,000 after a traffic accident. She suffered personal injury from the collision. Her insurance paid her $14,000 on the balance left due on her car, and she was currently receiving disability benefits from farmers. And even further, the trustee even admitted to the trial court that he was aware of her claim, notwithstanding the fact that she never did mention it and checked none for item 21, and he intended to abandon it. But there, the court concluded that the bankruptcy law obligates you to schedule your claim on the schedules provided, and here she checked the box marked none. And that is where the trustee and the bankruptcy court and creditors are entitled to look to see if there are any contingent or unliquidated claims, is the very line item asking for that information. And also, they said that in keeping with the Payne case and the Soto case and the other cases cited in our brief talking about generalities, that you can't just list it in broad general terms and then think that it would be somehow captured in those terms if you're later found out to not have included it. Now, I do need, before concluding, to mention briefly, we think the court, after Judge Milam ruled in favor of Mr. Strange on the standing question, the plaintiff then moved to substitute in the trustee and also to correct what he considered to be a misnomer. We submit this court has made clear that a party without standing, that action is a legal nullity, and you cannot come in and substitute someone ostensibly withstanding in place of someone who lacks it, so the court made the right result there. And a misnomer is a mistake in name, excuse me, a mistake in name but not person. Here the trustee and Ms. Ricketts are two separate entities. A misnomer was not the appropriate vehicle there, and the court appropriately ruled.
And we asked for under 317, he also asked to add the party under 317. That doesn't apply because that applies to people who become incapable of prosecuting the suit. She never was able to prosecute her.
Exactly, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Your time has expired. And so is yours.
Thank you.
Call the next case.